Welcome to Transcribed, Benchling's podcast where leaders share their personal journeys and hard-won lessons driving scientific progress. Today's guest, Kate Haviland, knows how to push through clinical setbacks and turn breakthrough science into life-changing therapies. As former CEO of Blueprint Medicines, Kate's leadership reflects the biggest lessons in biotech: holding conviction despite ambiguity, earning trust from teams, and building the resilience needed to turn bold science into real impact for patients.
Kate, thank you so much for being here today and joining us at Bench Talk.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to spend more time with you guys and to be here with all of you.
All right, well, we're gonna have an entertaining conversation for everyone to cap the day. I'm gonna dive right in and let's start with AYVAKIT.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So AYVAKIT is a first-in-class therapy for systemic mastocytosis, and under your leadership, it's grown to $500 million of revenue. Revenue is pretty cool at a biotech.
Yes.
Nice when it happens.
Very unusual.
with label expansions across multiple indications. Like the journey of most medicines, I'm guessing it wasn't a linear path, preordained from day one. Can you just give us a little bit of history about the molecule, some of the setbacks you faced, and what helped the Blueprint management team maintain conviction through those setbacks?
Yeah, absolutely. And so AYVAKIT, as Saji just mentioned, is the medicine that we brought from our labs at Blueprint Medicines that was very much designed to inhibit a specific mutation on a kinase called the D816V mutation. Our scientists, actually the founders of Blueprint Medicines, were the folks who founded and developed Gleevec. One of the most notable and really put targeted therapies on the map in terms of the impact it can have on patients. And they had worked for years to try to figure out how to take Gleevec and engineer into a very selective and potent inhibitor of this mutation. And they had not been able to do it. And so that was the founding premise of Blueprint Medicines, which is to develop a library of high quality molecular chemicals across the kinome. And the idea would be that instead of kind of using a hypothesis driven approach, if you were able to achieve that, you could then go in and find novel chemistry against the targets that you were looking for while avoiding the kind of off target effects or other types of activity that you were not looking for.
And what year was this like?
So Blueprint was really founded in 2011.
Okay.
So 2011, yeah.
Takes a long time to build something great.
It took 2 years for them to really build the platform, and then AYVAKIT kind of came out of that, and as well did as other molecules that were part of our portfolio. So we looked at AYVAKIT as potentially having the opportunity to be both impactful in a type of solid tumor called GI stromal tumors, or GIST. And there's kind of two flavors of that tumor that is driven, one by a homologous mutation to D816V, which is called the PDGFR alpha mutation. And then there's KIT mutations that are the predominant driver of disease and GI stromal tumors, and there's a range of those. And patients kind of develop resistance, as you often see in solid tumors. And then the D816V mutation is the driver mutation, the singular driver mutation of systemic mastocytosis, which is also a spectrum of disease that ranges from a very severe leukemia, where patients have about 6 months to live, to a more, what they call indolent, very much a misnomer, but a disease where patients don't really have a decreased lifespan, although that's questionable, but really just have a huge burden of disease where they cannot live life the way any of us are able to live life. You can't go to the grocery stores. You just have this very unpredictable disease that makes your life very difficult to be around other people, to be to travel, to kind of be outside, to work outside the home, things like that. And so we began developing AYVAKIT across multiple indications. And in the traditional targeted therapy way, we put it first into these PDGFR alpha driven GIST patients, and we saw responses right away. So when you hit a driver mutation hard with a novel medicine, you will shrink tumors, right? And we've seen that. And then the question is, can you do that in such a way where you can really provide long-term benefit to patients, where the cancer doesn't kind of mutate around? And that's where that potency part came in terms of the selectivity and potency of the molecule. So that was really the first opportunity for us when we saw in the first set of patients who were enrolled to start to understand that the AYVAKIT was doing what we designed it to do.
Yep.
And it was having the intended clinical effect.
So is that it? Clinic and then boom, you got a blockbuster medicine?
Or? Not really, right? I mean, as you said, the twists and turns. You know, so we felt that if we saw this activity in PDGFR-alpha, we're feeling really, really good about, we originally were only planning to develop AYVAKIT in the advanced form of systemic mastocytosis because it's a kinase inhibitor. And, you know, we didn't know if we could actually have a clinical profile that would be appropriate for patients with a non-life-threatening portion of the disease, which is the vast majority of SM patients.
I see. So you had confidence in this smaller segment of the patient
yes.
population, and then there was a big, you know, the thing that would really take this medicine and help it reach a lot of people would be a label.
To these bigger indications, both in GI stromal tumors or in SM.
Okay.
We first went after it in GI stromal tumors. Those tumors are more heterogeneic. They have more mutations. And that phase 3 study failed.
Phase 3. Okay. Phase so three. That's a pretty yes. expensive failure.
That was a pretty expensive failure. And we had tested the medicine in late-line patients with that same type of mutational profile. And we had seen nice overall response rates for patients who are, you know, multiple lines of therapy in. But when we moved up in line, we expected actually those patients to be less heterogeneic. And it turns out it was more the biology of the disease that we had, you know, misread there. And so it didn't so much change our view of AYVAKIT as it did the opportunity, which is to go to this much larger indication in GI stromal tumors, which actually had a business impact on us.
Mm.
So then we had to really think, okay, well,
you're a public company. So.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we know that the medicine works in these small populations, but those are really not kind of the type of opportunity that is going to create enough return for investors and also enable us to continue to invest in research. And
so what do you do?
Yeah, so I think, you know, luckily because AYVAKIT was so potent, we saw, you know, its activity at very low doses. And that opened up an opportunity for us to go into the less severe portion of systemic mastocytosis. So we think there's about 60,000 people with SM in the United States. About 2,500 of them have the more aggressive leukemic form. So the vast majority have what's called indolent systemic mastocytosis. And when we saw that AYVAKIT was so potent and had this clinical impact at low doses, we decided to take the chance to move it forward at a much lower dose. So our labeled dose for the advanced setting, the aggressive leukemia, is 200 milligrams once a day. And our labeled dose for the less severe patients is 25 milligrams.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Once a day. So significantly different. And what we were kind of rolling the dice on is that at that dosage, we could have such important impact on a patient's disease, but also make it a very tolerable medicine that someone could take chronically for years. And that is indeed what has kind of come to pass. And it is really the indolent form of systemic mastocytosis has enabled, you know, AYVAKIT to do over $500 million.
Is that a controversial decision in the company at the time to, you know, run it at a tenth of the dose, basically?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, I think choosing doses, pharmacology, all these things that are so critically important, I mean, they're highly debated, certainly controversial in terms of, like, you know, particularly when you're used to being oncology drug developers, right? And in oncology, you go as high as you can until, you know, in terms of hitting the patients because the disease is so aggressive and you're really truly trying to save people's lives. So it's a different kind of value proposition you're trying to bring forward. And so here you have a team of oncology people who are thinking about a disease that's more a disease of kind of allergic inflammation, more akin to asthma or some of these other, I mean, more severe than asthma, I'd say, well, depends. But, you know, a very different type of disease. And that was very much a stretch for us to
sure.
think about not just dosing, but how do you even...
You built a team for one
yes.
one type of kind
yep.
of outcome and
yes.
you need a team for a different type of outcome.
And what is amazing is that the team that ran the phase 3 study for GI stromal tumors moved and ran the phase 3 study in indolent systemic mastocytosis.
Wow. Okay.
And I think, you know, that is a little bit of our philosophy of Blueprint, which is really smart people can do many things if you support them in doing it and you still bring in expertise. I mean, we brought in some expertise around it as well, but we didn't feel that we had to hire a full team.
Can you share how you manage kind of employee and investor confidence
yep.
while kind of executing? I don't want to call it a pivot, but it was a twist.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, as CEO, your job is to kind of paint the picture of what can be and where can the science go and what is, and also be very much grounded in what the science is telling you. And I think, you know, I think for both investors and internal employees, you know, you have to, if you're squinting at your data to try to see something, you're probably not doing the right thing, right? But it's this balance between, you know, what is the data telling you and also understanding the limitations of any given data set, of which there are always limitations. And so, you know, how do you, what's that push and pull between understanding those limitations and believing that, that there's a signal there that is worth continuing to invest in and to bring forward? Or are you squinting too hard to see something that's really not there?
So the hardest thing is just accepting the truth.
Exactly, data. Or as much as the truth, because it's always ambiguous and you never have perfect information, right?
So with AvaKit now kind of poised to be this blockbuster medicine, like how did its success shape Blueprint's overall strategy and culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, we had a team, we have some employees at Blueprint still who have been there for the whole journey. So we're some of the first employees of the company, and I think that's unusual. So we had a long tenured team, new colleagues as well who came in. But we went through a lot of ups and downs together. I mean, through all of this, you know, when our phase 3 study failed, that was in April of 2020. So that was also right in the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And, I feel like, you know, one of the things I'd say is that we had numerous ups and downs of the company that we weathered together. And I was talking to the company over the last couple of years with some of the other uncertainties in biotech, when you have a great team and you have conviction and you're data driven, you will meet these moments, right? And you will find your way through. And I think there's a little bit of, as a leader, making sure that you show that confidence that we will make this, we'll make our way through these changes and we will pivot with what the science is telling us. But you also have to explain why. And I think that's similar to investors. Like, why do we believe that AvaKit was going to be a really important medicine for indolent systemic mastocytosis? We actually had to spend a lot of time talking about ISM because it wasn't a well-characterized disease. No medicines have ever been approved for it before. And trying to help people understand how important the medical need was. Because, you know, compared to, you know, a leukemia where someone may die in 6 months, well, that's clear. That's clear and obvious to everybody how severe that disease is. Something like indolent systemic mastocytosis, you have to bring that to life. Like, how bad is it for people who live with this disease? What is it that they can't do? And why is it an important medicine that we should all spend our time on? And so we had to kind of learn about that.
So you had to educate the investor community.
And ourselves and our internal employees and about why this was meaningful, why it was worth both our time and our human resources as well as our financial resources.
Let's talk M&A.
Yeah.
So I think how acquisitions actually happen is probably a total mystery to most people. It seems so clean from the outside, but you never really get to read about all the conversations that didn't go anywhere, all the ups and downs. And I'm sure the Sanofi acquisition was a roller coaster from, you know, early talks about Blue 808 to, you know, some breakdown in negotiations to a dinner in Paris. You know, it sounds very almost romantic and mysterious that they revived the deal. Like, can you just take us inside the M&A process?
Yeah, so we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but you know, I think that old adage that great companies are bought, they're not sold, is true. And I think what's most important is that you build a company and you work on science that is important, and that is, and you have a differentiated view from others, and that you can continue to demonstrate the value that you're bringing to patients, because at the end of the day, that's what all of us want to be doing. And you know, these types of, you were talking about, so much about this is personal relationships, and you know, one of the job of a CEO, and I felt this, is to make sure that the company has optionality, and that includes in BD. So during my tenure at Blueprint, we brought in over $1.3 billion in business development transactions. We did a number of different types of transactions. And part of that is just always being out there talking to your colleagues in big pharma, knowing what they're strategically interested in, what do they know about the company, what is intriguing to them about the work that we're doing, what is their strategic areas of focus, is it breast cancer, is it lung cancer, is it, you know, blood disorders, is it I&I, and always making sure you have a sense of that. And I think over the years, I was able to build relationships with the transaction leads in big pharma, some of the important kind of business unit leaders, including also some of the CEOs, like Paul Hudson and others. And so, it is very much a relationship-based event, and it always starts with business development. And so Blue 808 was our next drug in development coming through the clinic. And what we would say is that it was actually, instead of inhibiting a mutated form of the KIT receptor and tyrosine kinase, it was inhibiting the wild type form. And the idea there is that, you know, if you can just calm down mast cells, which are very much the core, we believe really core and fundamental to many diseases of type 2 inflammation, that you could impact an array of diseases. And so we actually, one of our investors and one of our analysts called it a potential oral Dupixent. So Sanofi was a very obvious choice to have a conversation around Blue 808, right? And we knew that if it truly did have the opportunity to be impactful across numerous disease states of type 2 inflammation, it'd likely be something that we would need to partner to bring it forward to really realize the full value of it. And so the conversations with Sanofi really did start around BLU 808 and then continued to evolve to also include some of our some of the things we were working on in science and discovery that are not in the public domain, but also AYVAKIT. So,
what was the kind of turning point that convinced you that an acquisition was the right path forward for the company? Because it sounds like it started as like a partnership conversation.
Yeah, I mean, these are tricky conversations. I mean, this is obviously in consultation with our board of directors. As I said, you want to be a company that has a really strong go-forward operating plan, and we are very confident both in AYVAKIT's trajectory and our ability to commercially execute it through and beyond a blockbuster medicine. And we were really excited about the potential of 808, plus all the other things that we were doing at the company. And so we had a go-forward plan that we were all very much behind, that our team was executing well against. And so when something comes forward, you have to really sit there and say, okay, will an acquisition by a larger company be able to get this medicine to more patients globally faster? Will 808 be able to go into more disease states faster than we can do it on our own? Can we get a value for it that is a good return as a fiduciary of the company for our investors? Mm-hmm. And I think you have to kind of sit and ask yourself those questions. And the answer is not always yes. I think in the case with Sanofi, given the strategic focus, and I think one thing that really distinguished Sanofi for me in terms of other conversations I had was they were also very much interested in the Blueprint team. And that was important to me. Sanofi has stated publicly that their plan is to be the world leaders in immunology in 2030. And they have a proprietary pipeline of programs coming through that I think is really exciting from that perspective. Their flagship product, which we all know is Dupixent, incredible medicine, that's in partnership with Regeneron. So all of their kind of commercial and medical teams are all shared between the two. And so they needed, I think one of the things that they valued in Blueprint is the fact we had this high performing team that could be kind of the tip of the spear for them as they built behind it to have their own non-kind of collaboration related infrastructure and people. And that was different than other conversations that I was having where people were more interested in
the assets
themselves. And so that was very much distinguishing.
What was the most controversial or difficult part of the decision?
I think it's that decision, right? To say that we think, to make the decision that another company can get this to patients faster, can go bigger, can realize the potential of the science and the medicine in a way that we just can't. And to kind of have to really sit down with a team, because we had such a strong go forward operating plan, our team was executing exceptionally well. And I think it's, to have that decision to say, okay, we should entertain this. And then of course it comes to value, right? You need to make sure you're getting value that makes sense for the potential of where the company stands, so.
Kind of talking more about partnerships, yep. You've been called Blueprint's deal mastermind. So structuring collaborations with Roche, Ipsen, Seastone, Zylab, and Lengo. What do you wish more people understood about successful biopharma collaborations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I think everyone should be humble and really think about what is it that you are really good at? What is it that your company does exceptionally well? And to value the people across the table from you and what they do really well, right?
You think that gets like lost in a lot of
I think it does get lost. Okay. I think there's on both sides of the equation, there could be a not invented here kind of phenomena, which is like, oh, this can't be as good as what we would have done internally, or these guys just don't understand. And there's a little bit of that kind of goes on, because I think inevitably, particularly if it's a large company and a smaller company, people talk about finding a cultural fit. Well, there is no cultural fit between an 80,000 person company and a 600 person company. I mean, it's just like, it doesn't exist, right? And I think what you want to do is find a group of people who you can work through issues with, because there will be issues. And every deal you do, you get the deal done and then you live with it. And there's going to be times when, things crop up, and some of that may be cultural or ways of working. And often in biotech, we parallel process a bunch of things. In larger companies, they do things more sequentially. And so you have to figure out how to negotiate those types of kind of day-to-day plans around programs that you're collaborating with or that you have licensed. And so I think there's a little bit of, I also think that some people approach these transactions with a kind of winner-take-all, like zero-sum game.
Talk more about that, please.
You want to have a deal where everyone feels like they've made compromises.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've won some things and you've given some things, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, if one party walks away feeling that they've kind of have gotten everything on their list or that they kind of put it to the other party, that's not going to be a successful beginning to or launching into a collaboration. And so I think you have to go in to say, you know, we're going to have to give on some stuff that we want. You have to think about what your priorities are and how do you find that middle ground with another party and understand what do they need strategically? Why are they even entertaining this type of transaction? And try to really put yourself in their shoes to say, okay, I understand why they're looking at this and what this can do for them. Well, we need to make sure that we don't structure the deal in such a way that they lose that value because then they'll want to walk away.
One thing you've said before is that financials are obviously important, but they should never be the driver of the deal.
Yes.
Can you just give us an example of a deal where like another factor was actually much more important?
Yeah, I mean, so I think business development should be core to you achieving your corporate strategy. And so however you think about that from a company perspective. So a great example is, we actually had a program in the early days of Blueprint in hepatocellular carcinoma. So it was an FGFR4 inhibitor. At the time, IO was just coming into liver cancer at that point, and we're starting to see some interesting impact. And what we realized is that we actually had some great early data, but it wasn't durable. So we were getting, 35, 40% response rate, which is huge in late line liver cancer patients. But they were losing the effect in 6 months, right? So not something we needed to find a way to increase durability. In the meantime, we had all these other programs moving forward at Blueprint. And so what we decided to do was partner the liver cancer program. At that moment, from a macro perspective, China was really opening up to innovative medicine development because now companies could list on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. This was back in 2018. So we took advantage of the fact that actually HCC is highly prevalent in China. Mm-hmm. Numerous kind of biotech companies were being created in China looking for innovative medicines. And so we were one of the first biotech companies to do a deal in China. And the whole goal was because we were deprioritizing our HCC program for ourselves, but we wanted to see it move forward in the hands of a partner. And then we ended up actually licensing our series of clinical assets at that point, because if we're going to have a partner in China, we might as well do all. We chose a partner. We did not choose the partner that gave us the highest upfront, or actually the highest economics. We actually chose a partner that we thought would be able to kind of navigate this new kind of system being developed in China to list on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, and who we thought that we could really work with because it's such a different place to work, including developing medicines, but also commercializing them. And so we actually prioritized over the economics that strategic fit in that case. So,
so you studied biochemistry and molecular biology in your undergrad,
yep.
but your career has been very focused on commercial and BD
yep.
roles. One thing that's very interesting about biotech leadership is it really requires you to make these big capital and risk allocation decisions that blend a bunch of very technical, scientific, clinical, and regulatory judgment. You obviously have a great management team, but can you take us through like how you think about your role and how you make those really big calls, like how much research and tech ops to invest in, which programs to cut or advance, like which trials to fund?
I think as a CEO, one of the most important things you need to do is capital allocation, particularly as you have a growing organization, right? And so, we had to think very hard as we moved from a discovery to development stage and then development to commercial stage. You had to constantly be building kind of the next set of expertise and infrastructure, but you still wanted to be funding kind of what was, more of the mature parts of the organization, be that discovery or development as time happens, and how do you kind of constantly balance those things? It's definitely an art, it's not a science.
No algorithm.
You often figure out if you got it right in the rearview mirror, which is tough,
like
right?
Years later.
Years later.
Yeah.
Or even you can have consequences in the moment of kind of underfunding something. I think for me, it's one of the things I think is really important in biotech because it is so fast moving, because the macroeconomic dynamics matter, and you have imperfect information and a tremendous amount of ambiguity. You have to have that team, right, where there you can hear a lot of different views and opinions, but at the end of the day, you have to make the decision as CEO, and I think what you have to do is integrate those perspectives and decide what to do. And part of that is deciding what are the three most important value drivers of the company and making sure you're fully funding those, and then finding other ways, you know, creative ways. Like, for instance, our HCC program, it got deprioritized in our portfolio. We found a creative way to move it forward by out-licensing it, right? We continued to have some upside there, but we were not going to put as much of our capital against it. So I think it's how do you kind of constantly be shifting things and find creative ways to continue working on other things that may be of value but aren't the priority at the company. I also think it's really important for the executive level team to be, you know, clear and aligned on what those three most important things are. If everything is a priority, nothing's a priority. And you have to be clear on what are the key you know, priorities for the year and for the longer term. And over the longer term, that will shift, right? As programs develop, as you find out more, as the field develops, if there's other programs for other companies that look better than yours, I mean, you have to constantly be evaluating that and deciding how you're gonna shift and allocate capital differently. So, we stopped as many programs as we brought forward.
Really? Okay. Yes. Half of Blueprint's executive team are women, which is above industry norm. Can you tell us about concrete steps you've taken to build a company and culture that can kind of recruit and develop the best people, no matter their demographic background?
Yeah, I think building culture intentionally is one of the most important things that you need to do as a leader of a team, a leader of a company. And it is critical from the earliest stages. And it's one of the reasons why I was really interested in coming to Blueprint. And I think it's because, you know, we just talked about how we work in a very dynamic environment that where there's ambiguity, there's no perfect data, facts change, where you get new data sets, and you have to be able to pivot and you have to be resilient, right? You know, the efforts that we make day after day are best measured year over year. And that can be, you know, our timelines are such, that can be really tricky place to work. And so I think a few things around culture, and you're saying about around diversity, I think you need a diversity of people and opinions. You need to have debate and a range of opinions around a table to manage effectively in an environment of ambiguity where there's no one right answer and imperfect information. So if you're gonna make good decisions, you wanna have that kind of robust debate and diversity of perspectives around the table. Now that does not mean, I do not believe in consensus-driven decision-making. I believe that there should still be one person whose job it is to take any given decision in that room, and it's incumbent upon them to listen and hear the debate and integrate all these viewpoints and take a decision, right, and move forward. There are very few decisions that when you kind of take that decision and move forward, the door shuts behind you, right? Most of the time,
doors.
What you do is you move down the line, you get more information. If you need to pivot, you pivot, right? And you just constantly have to keep moving forward. And so I think that's part of it. I think, from a culture perspective, I very much believe in guardrails, not checklists. Because if you give any great group of team of people a checklist, they'll go and dutifully fill out and check every box. But if you don't give them a checklist and you just give guardrails and say, I need a plan and I need you to think about your risks, I need to think you to think about your budget, I need to think about your key inflection points this year, go away and kind of come back with something, that team is gonna iterate on that, they're gonna own it, they're gonna come back with something really thoughtful, and they're gonna be ready to go. Right, and that's going to be an empowered organization that then can navigate all the things we just talked about. And so I think when you give templates and you give checklists, it may be more efficient in the moment, but it actually, I think, kind of undercuts productivity and the ability to manage ambiguity and to be resilient and to kind of make shifts along the way. And so I think I think it's a much better idea to do the guardrail approach.
I like that.
Yeah, I think so. I think those are important in culture. I think where decisions are made are important. You know, decisions should not be all made at the executive team. You should keep as much decision making closest to the programs and the people who know the most about them as possible. I think leadership is not hierarchy. And if people are kind of executing because their boss told them to do so, you're never going to get the most out of your people, and you're not going to be able to kind of leverage their talent and their creativity and their innovation and their expertise. And so you really have to believe that being a leader is about, you know, setting this context for great people to do their best work and setting these kind of parameters around which someone can really contribute to their fullest ability. And only then are you going to be able to really kind of succeed, I think, in being more than the sum of your parts.
You said before that your fingerprints are all over Blueprint, from commercial to international to
yes.
to manufacturing.
Yeah. I think I managed every function at least for some amount of time.
All right. How has that breadth of kind of internal experience shaped your leadership style as CEO?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting is we are all one blueprint, but knowing, having experience in kind of each of these different functions, whether, you know, I had tech ops reported to me, I had our information services, I had the international, I built the international team. You know, you have a lot more, I don't know if it's empathy or understanding of what it's like to be in the Italian affiliate of Blueprint Medicines, or to be in the tech ops help desk, or to be kind of in supply chain, right? I mean, you just have a better sense of what people's daily lives are like, which are very different across functions in our business, right? If you're in biotech, you know, you're all working on the same program, you're all pulling in the same direction, but you're doing things that are very different on a day-to-day basis from each other. And I think having, you know, had the opportunity to work with all these teams and such great people, I learned a tremendous amount about all these different aspects of the business, but I also have a very good sense of why, you know, for instance, when you're prioritizing portfolio programs, well, that doesn't really, you know, apply to our quality colleagues, because we need high quality across everything, and you know that, right? So you have to think about resourcing. It goes directly to your ability to allocate capital well, goes directly to your ability to judge risks and where to kind of take a risk versus where not to, and how to think about it. And I think that kind of breadth of exposure, for me at least, really, to your point, like we never get taught how to do these things, but hone my ability to do that.
Probably gives you a ton of credibility across the company
too. And gives you a lot of credibility and an ability to kind of like speak everyone's language a little bit.
You described your leap from Genzyme to PTC as a, yeah, you know, transformative, because it forced you to take risks and say yes to challenges. Looking back, like what's like the riskiest bet you've made in your career?
Well, I think personally that was one of the risks. You know, I was
what made it risky?
Yeah, I was, in terms of like taking like kind of a personal professional risk, I was going from Genzyme to PTC. I mean, I had been in Boston. I loved Genzyme. The opportunity at PTC came up. Like, you know, I went from Kendall Square in the Genzyme building, sitting on the 11th floor in corporate development, to literally this company that was off of Highway 287, as I don't know if you guys know, in New Jersey, behind a shut down Pathmark in this like low building. I remember driving out there and being like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? Personally, at the same time, my partner and I, he and I had just bought our first apartment in Boston. So I took the job at PTC, we closed on our apartment in Boston, and the movers moved half of our stuff to an apartment for me in New York when I took that. So it was a tremendous kind of personal risk at the time as well. And when I went to PTC, you know, I had no job description, and it was, you know, I at the time Stuart Peltz, who was the founder and longtime CEO at PTC, who was a wonderful, incredible leader, who I learned a lot from, you know, he said to me, he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, I want to kind of do anything and everything, but I want to go to every board meeting and I want to go to every regulatory meeting. And he said, okay, that's great. And so I was able to do that, and that really expanded my horizons. I think professionally, probably one of the biggest risks I took was to really kind of redirect Blueprint Medicines, whose heritage has been very much in oncology. And we were very formed by that and defined by that, including myself. And
it's
really
tough to change your identity.
It's tough to change. And we were, you know, we weren't, I mean, we went public in 2015, and we weren't that old as a company. I mean, we're a pretty young company, to then really pivot the company around what the science was telling us, and to get people excited about the opportunity around mast cell biology, and I got excited about it too. And the knowledge we were gaining through our experience with AYVAKIT and systemic mastocytosis, and then with BLU-808 and other things we were doing, and how powerful that felt. And I don't believe Sanofi bought us for AYVAKIT. I think they bought us because we are some of the world leaders in understanding mast cell biology and how to modulate that to impact disease. And I think that's really where that acquisition came from. And so I think kind of moving Blueprint in that direction, and, you know, we stopped some of our EGFR lung cancer programs, including the program we'd bought in. It's our only acquisition that we made. That was a bold decision.
And turned it off?
Yeah. We stopped it because the data did not suggest we could move to frontline. And, you know, we had a 60% response rate in the second line. I mean, some people thought we were crazy for not pursuing it. But what we saw, and we published some of this in kind of the ctDNA and others, was that we didn't think we were going to have the impact we needed to have to really impact frontline patients. And so we decided to allocate our capital more towards BLU-808 and to move more towards the direction of modulating mast cell biology and I&I. And that was a pretty big decision to do that.
You've got a lot of the next generation of scientists in this room.
Yeah.
Many of them who are going to pursue careers, you know, rise up through the ranks of scientific leadership, but also, yeah, some who may eventually move over to the business or medical side. Like, What advice do you have to them as they think about the business side of biotech?
Yeah, one of the things I loved about Blueprint is both our chief commercial officer and our chief business officer both had PhDs, which I always thought was really cool.
They were scientists
first. They were scientists first. I think that curiosity, that willing to kind of, you know, raise your hand to do new things, that ability to kind of integrate information quickly and to seek different points of view and to be curious about, you know, what people are next to you are doing or why or what your colleagues in different departments are doing. I think those are all the types of things that are the qualities that I look for in people. You know, one of the things I'm really proud at Blueprint is that we did have people completely change functions and move around the company and take on different roles. And just as much as I was telling you that the team who ran the phase 3 study for GI stromal tumors that failed moved and then ended up executing the first of its kind phase 3 study for indolent systemic mastocytosis with a PRO endpoint that they had to develop, right? Not shrinking tumors, it's very different. And they did a tremendous job and got us to the, you know, a new class of medicines for these patients and blazed a new regulatory and clinical development path. And so I truly believe that people can come up learning curves quickly if they have the right kind of drive, motivation, support, and, you know, confidence from their managers or leaders that they can do it. And I think if you have people in those settings, I think you can really kind of take your career in many different directions. So.
Who are some of the mentors that have changed your career, and what did they teach you?
So Jeff Albers, who was the CEO of Blueprint, was our chair he was the chair of our board when we were bought. I mean, he was my direct mentor. He's who I joined the company to work for, and he's the one who I would say, supported me all along the way, including, you know, telling me that he thought I should get a board seat. He thought I'd be a better executive at Blueprint if I was on a board, and he helped support me in doing that. I had both my kids at Blueprint, and I will never forget that, you know, I was pregnant when I was interviewing with Jeff for the chief business officer role. And I said to my husband, I was like, I should probably tell him, right? And my husband was like, no, we haven't told our families yet. Like, I mean, it was like so early. Like, why would you tell this guy you're about to work for? So I didn't. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like, you know, and so I joined, we're a couple months in, everything was looking good with the pregnancy. So I went in to tell him, and I was a little trepidatious about it. And he just he was so excited for me, got up and gave me a huge hug and didn't even say, okay, let's figure out how to manage it. He's like, I'm just so thrilled for you. Ask me a bunch of questions. And he's like, we'll figure out how to manage it later. Don't worry about it. I think it's like having someone like that who both supports you personally and professionally and believes in you. I also got probably the hardest professional reviews I've ever had in my life from Jeff Albers.
Mm.
And I think if you're working in an organization that takes performance management seriously, you're in a good spot. Now you have to get that. You have to get that kind of constructive feedback from someone you trust really wants you to be successful, right? They're giving you the feedback because they want you to be successful.
What do you feel like he really pushed you on?
Oh my gosh, I mean, different things over time, right? I mean, I think a lot of it, I think in order, once I became COO, I was clearly his successor at that point. So I started off as chief business officer, I was promoted to chief operating officer in 2018, and then took on CEO in 2022. And I was clearly his successor at that point. And so, you know, a lot of it was about how to kind of set a vision, but let people operate, you know, independently and with autonomy within that and deliver the way they want to deliver, but making sure that we're all pulling in the same direction. And, you know, because a lot of it is how to scale. And if you're someone who feels like you have to be in every room and that you have to take every decision and you're missing out and you're not empowering people around you, you won't be able to scale. You cannot grow if you kind of cap the organization like that. And so Jeff really, you know, helped me. And I think one of the tricks for all of us is we come up because we become independent contributors, right? We do really good work as individuals. And so you're not, you know, that skill set of leading a team where those individuals are driving the business and you're not, is something you have to learn, right? And so I think Jeff really pushed me hard on how to be a strong leader who invests in people, holds them accountable, sets a vision, and lets them operate, right? And that can be really hard when you're the one who's used to kind of negotiating the deal or doing those types of activities yourself. So.
Kate, thank you so much. This is a fabulous conversation. We really appreciate you taking the time to share.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. Yeah. It's a lot of fun, so I appreciate it. So. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It was great.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.